Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Sayantani Dasgupta. She's an associate professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and we're talking about her new book, Brown Women Have Everything, Essays on Discomfort and Delight. Sayantani, it's a pleasure to talk to you after almost 10 years when we talked about your first book. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mark. This is such a treat to be in conversation with you.
I'll tell you, it was a treat reading this book. This is a collection of short pieces. Would you call them essays technically, or are they just short? Is there another name for what these are?
I would call them essays, creative nonfiction, yes.
Did they appear in other places?
A few of them do, but as it's kind of, you know, required and expected with any new book coming out, most of the content is unpublished and just new to this book.
Did you write specifically for this collection, or do you just happen to have these pieces around?
I mean, I write all the time. And then when a pattern starts to emerge and it seems like, okay, there are some common themes here that can be tied together, that's when it starts taking the shape of a book. So a lot of these essays were written standalone for various literary journals and magazines. And then when I started seeing that they do have lots of things in common,
yeah,
it just made sense to start working towards putting them in this particular book shape.
Did you also put them intentionally in the chronological order?
So the order was decided in conversation with my editor. And the manuscript I had submitted to my press, the essays were in a specific order that had made sense to me at that time. But I was very open to editorial comments about changes with respect to the order and with respect to pretty much everything else, because what good editors can do, absolutely writers cannot. I was very happy to have my editor weigh in and tell me like what essays seem like a good fit next to each other, so on and so forth. And I'm very happy that the content looks the way it does now.
Is this an editor you've had before?
I'm sorry?
Is this an editor you've worked with before?
No, I have not. And this was my first time working with UNC Press. And when I was sending this manuscript out, it got interest from several presses. And then I ultimately went with UNC Press because I just felt so seen and heard in terms of all the conversations I had had with them.
Yeah.
And when you find a good fit like that, you cannot let go.
So
I'm very grateful.
I'm just a book review editor for an ornithology journal. And I'll tell you, having a good editor is everything.
Right.
It's a special relationship, but finding one is not that easy.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Now, the meaning behind the title.
Yes.
Brown Women Have Everything. When I first picked it up, I thought, oh, you know, it's sort of one of those, you know, positive, uplifting phrases, maybe like sort of almost a self-help book. But the origin of that is another story entirely. Can you just share that?
Yes, absolutely. So when I got my current job, I was at a faculty staff orientation. And the entire first week was various orientation activities. And then this particular event where two white women, probably in their early 60s, they welcomed me to the event. And then they said, well, of course you got the job. Brown women and black women have everything these days. They get all the jobs.
Oh.
And I remember being so taken aback by this assertion, because here we were in a large hall, and from where I was standing, I could probably see three or four people of color. And the idea that we are somehow taking over the world, I mean, that would be great, perhaps. But I think taking over the world also will come with a lot of responsibility. But jokes aside, it just was so bizarre that here is a physical reality that I can see, that all of us can see, and yet this assumption that somehow black women and brown women are taking over all the jobs. That was very strange. But
did you say anything to them at the time? That's like one of those things when you're confronted with that, so sort of bald-faced, right in your face.
Right.
You sort of don't even know how to respond to it.
Yes, but I do think I said something like, I think the jobs are still going to the best candidates for the jobs.
And good on you.
You know, random.
But you didn't get like indignant like you should have?
Maybe my face did. I can't remember my expression, but I definitely remember being taken aback by what they were saying.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
But now, 6 years later, I'm grateful to them for having said that, because that came as the title of the book, and everything got sort of tied around this theme of what is it that brown women have and do not have, or can have, cannot have, so on and so forth.
Are you going to give them copies of the book?
I don't think so. I think they should probably buy their own.
You're right. Now,
I mean, I don't think they're the reading kind, because if they were, they would probably be aware of just, you know, demographics and who still has all the jobs and all of those things.
These essays are amazing. I loved each and every one of them for different reasons. And
thank you.
They reveal so much about you as a person, both the person you present to other people and your internal person.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things readers will realize is how much your family and culture, they're such an important touchstone for you. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, those things are so important to you. And you made that clear in your first book, too.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who are not from a culture like that, like that actually has meaning, unlike our culture. It's weird to read about somebody who really cares about their family. I hate to say that, but it's really true, and that you can rely on them. And there's bad, and there's not so great aspects too. But you talk about that.
Right. I mean, the older I get, I think my sense of gratitude for the family I was born into, the family I still get to call mine, and of course the family I have made with, you know, friends and colleagues and everyone here in the States, I'm deeply grateful for these communities and these bonds. And this was, I think, especially clear because of the pandemic, when suddenly it seemed like we were cut off from everyone and these riches. And I feel I have sort of tried to be better as a communicator, as a person who can be relied on since the pandemic, because just this idea, just this understanding that we are really nothing without the people in our lives. And all the accolades, all the successes, they are never one person's alone, right? There's so much work that goes into propping each one of us up by all the people that surround us. So I feel a deep sense of gratitude, and I feel very lucky that I have the people in my life that I do.
I love reading about your young life in books. Talk about that, because you and I think in this way you're very much like me. I grew up with books all over the place, and it really formed who I am now.
Yeah, there really is not a better gift than that to give to a child, right?
Oh, yeah.
Just this power of imagination and what all it can unlock. And I was born and grew up with people. I was born in a family of readers and writers. And so everyone in my life always read and had very specific rituals around book reading. Like, okay, this is post lunch. It's going to be nap. It's going to be some reading time. Or there will be hours of newspaper reading in the morning. Those sorts of things. So reading was the most natural thing that adults in my life were doing. And the first, I was being told and read stories in Bengali, Hindi, and English. And then when I started learning these languages, I started reading in all of them. And it was a wonderful mishmash of characters inside my head, all that these people were doing, all the adventures they were going on, And the first book that had a phenomenal impact on me, and I write about that in this book, is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yes.
Which just blew me away that, and I read it as a nine-year-old, but this idea that all of these creatures, all of these submarines, he had just created them in his head. And at the time of Jules Verne, there was nothing called this kind of an underwater exploration that is very common, of course, now. And he made it all up. And that was just amazing and astonishing that, wait, someone can just do that and, you know, make this really cool thing happen. So here I was sitting in landlocked New Delhi reading Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues and thinking, okay, I've got to do this at one point, just make up things. And thankfully that turned out okay. That's also my job. That's my passion. So, yeah.
Wow.
All of that good stuff.
I really identified with that, with those. And in your childhood, you moved from one major sort of cultural center to another within India, too. And that was a that was a big deal to make that move.
Right, yes. I don't think so much for me, because, of course, I was just five. But and I still understood that there were these major changes happening because of how my parents were behaving in this new place and sort of the homesickness they felt and their gradual adjustment with New Delhi as opposed to when we first arrived in New Delhi from Calcutta. And it was a really good learning experience.
And I think that helped really form you, because then you just sort of took everything in stride. Your father sounded like it was a bigger adjustment for him.
For both of them, for both my parents, I think a lot of it had to do with language, because in Calcutta, of course, Bengali is the language of communication for everything. And then in Delhi, we were speaking in Hindi. And if you are in India, you, no matter the state, you develop a rudimentary understanding of Hindi. But then to be plunged into a city where that is the main language of communication, it can be a lot of adjustment, right? To switch from something that you've been speaking all the time to now something that you have not encountered as much. So I think the language was a huge barrier. Foods were a big barrier. And these things are difficult to understand now in 2024, when we have access to everything everywhere all the time.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, welcoming her back after so long a time, years went by, is Sayantini Dasgupta. She's Associate Professor of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and we're talking about her new book, which is just an outstanding collection of essays, Brown Women Have Everything, Essays on Discomfort and Delight. And this is in parentheses. So it's comfort and delight or discomfort and delight?
Since the dis is in parentheses, yeah. I kind of want to highlight that it's both discomfort as well as just pure comfort. And because even in the most comfortable situations, I think we crave a little bit of discomfort, because that makes the comfort sit better on us. Do you know what I mean?
Right. You can't appreciate the good times until you experience some of the more discomforting times.
Right, exactly. So we crave a little bit of tension, a little bit of grit, in no matter how much of a great day or a joyous day we might be having, in order to be able to appreciate all the good things that much more. So that's where I think the discomfort, comfort.
I think that's some of you, too. Because <It's like, laughs> you get yourself into some weird situations in the essays in this book. Like,
I do, yes.
Some of them are very frightening. There's a really scary essay in this book about you alone. Now, you were married, I think, at the time, but your husband was on the other coast, and a hurricane's bearing down on you. And here you are, you know, you just sort of relatively new to that area. It looks like it's going to be a direct hit, and you got to figure out what you're going to do.
Right. And I have never had any experience of hurricanes. I don't have any family in the States to speak of besides my husband, who at that time was, as you rightly said, he was in Idaho and I was in North Carolina. And then to have to figure out, okay, what is it that I'm doing? What do I have to do? all these instructions that were coming from our apartment company were also sort of bizarre, that wait, bring things inside, like what can happen? Because if you don't have a mental image of everything that a hurricane can bring, it's a really bizarre set of instructions to receive the first time. Now, of course, 6 years in, I understand hurricanes. I am terrified of hurricanes even more because of course, all the havoc that they have been causing.
Well, yeah, especially in the western part of the state that you're in.
I'm on the coast.
I know. So you weren't affected by all that rain?
I wasn't affected by Hurricane Helene. But it seemed absolutely bizarre to wake up to the news of everything that had happened in western North Carolina.
Yeah.
And that the storm had gone so far inland and affected so many communities. So, yeah, terrifying.
There's also another essay, and I have to ask you about this because I couldn't figure out whether you were just going through the motions like a drill or if this actually happened. In case of an active shooter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that a drill or was that an actual event that happened?
It was an actual event that happened.
Oh, my God.
That was also deeply terrifying to be suddenly in charge of 19 students when our laptops are flashing active shooter alert. And this weird sensation of, wait, I have been hired to teach them. Now I have to protect them. How do I do that? I am not trained to do that. Should I be trusted to do that?
So wait a minute. There was no training, formal training in a classroom for teachers to how to deal with an active shooter?
Although We have training. But I think what I'm trying to say is, if you are off that, if you have grown up with that mindset that I'm going to be a warrior, I'm going to be able to take care of people, that's a different thing altogether. But if you are like me, who grew up thinking I'm going to be a writer, then a teacher, but then it's not your second nature to, okay, now I'm just going to, you know, switch into my warrior mode and protect people.
I'm depressed that I live in a culture where that has to be done.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, we never had any of this. I grew up in the 50s. So this kind of problem never, ever happened. And now to live in a culture where, you know, classroom teachers and professors have to be drilled in this, to me, is depressing.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're also from a different country, which is the case for me, it's a different level of terrifying, right? Because it's not something I have confronted in my classroom ever back home. And in the India in which I grew up, only the cops had guns and bad guys had guns.
Yeah.
So the fact that a random person in your neighborhood school could just show up and cause this kind of havoc is just, my mind cannot wrap itself around that.
Well, the amazing thing about the essay is it takes you through step by step what's going on in your mind as you're going through the things. It's a really powerful essay. It's surreal almost. I mean, there was a weird, oneric, like dreamlike sense to the, you know, is she really facing this? Like, that's why I couldn't believe that you would be facing this, and yet you were. Now on to a hot, happier topic. There's some great food memories in this book. Both food disasters, which we'll allude to, but there's so many memories from you never learned to cook.
Not as a kid, not as a teenager, but the first time I started living on my own, I had to figure out how to cook.
And so did your mother not let you cook? Did she not want you to cook?
So my parents were very much of the opinion that you will figure it out once you are out and about, because they didn't know until, you know, they got married and they sort of moved out of their parents' orbit, like how to cook. So because they figured it out, it was, I think, understood, imagined, expected that you will figure it out as well. And I had never really shown much interest in learning how to cook. So maybe that was another reason why I wasn't taught.
You're too busy reading.
I was too busy reading. And I was very happy to be fed all these wonderful meals. I didn't think that I had to learn them until later, of course.
But, But there's all these things in the book that I really wish I would have an opportunity to taste myself, like Druk's orange marmalade.
Yeah, Druk's orange marmalade. That's a jam. And it was a loved jam in my home. And it is. So it's important that the chewiness is, is really revered. So that was that kind of jam.
Can you get it here in the States?
I have never seen it.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your mother's tomato chutney.
Oh, yes. That is the food of God.
You really wax rhapsodic in the book in one of the essays about it. And it was one of those things while I'm reading it, I'm going like, damn it. And I'm not even going to try cooking it because it'll obviously never come out at anything near correctly, which is another thing that comes out in this book is it seems like everybody who's trying to somehow, I guess, get on your good side, decide to invite you for some Indian cooking. Boy, did they invite the wrong person. Because you care about this stuff. So this sort of lame attempt at identifying as Indian by cooking a pale version of a dish just sort of seems like a weird thing. Oh, my God. You had one hilariously bad meal with Stuart and Sandra.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Definitely not what I was expecting.
Well, there were warning signs as you went along. You just didn't pick up on them.
I didn't. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that I was barely a month old in the U.S. I was intimidated by the fact that these were professors at my university who had invited me to their home. I was thrilled, of course, but also let me make sure that I'm behaving properly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There is, no situation where they have to make a complaint against me, maybe to my department or to my department chair. So, and also, I guess, not really knowing all the boundaries of hospitality, where I can say no, what I can say no to, and not knowing the city. So not feeling like I can say a quick goodbye and leave and find my way back home. So it was a combination of everything, my own newness, sort of nervousness. And because I had been to a professor's house right before then, and that had been a wonderful experience, I went into this dinner thinking it will be exactly the same. And of course, the two experiences could not have been more different.
Yeah. People who are listening need to read that essay, Killer Dinner. There were the cats, which you're not a big fan of, but there was a thing where they had two refrigerators, you opened one of them and it was like something out of a horror movie.
Yes, absolutely. They had two fridges and one had cheese, dairy, those kinds of things. And that was fine. And the other one, they said, stocked fresh vegetables. And those vegetables were fresh back when the world was created. Because they had not thrown out anything that had ever spoiled or gotten old or moldy, fuzzy. And these vegetables were like black in color.
Oh, my God.
So it was like, what is happening? I feel like now if someone invited me, now having lived here for almost 18 years, I would be like, okay, I think I need to go home. I'm remembering something has come up, or I'll make an excuse to leave. But at that time, it just didn't even occur to me that I could say or do anything like that. So terrifying.
We just have a few minutes left. I was going to ask you to read, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. What I love about your essays too is you have a real passion for detail. In your essay, A City in Seven Metaphors, about Wilmington, there's a section about a knobbed whelk.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really love that, that you walked on the beach, you picked up this shell, and it's now in a drawer. And it's details like that that I really make this writing come alive.
Thank you. It was a fun sort of memory to revisit. And I had, it was my first Thanksgiving in Wilmington and the first Thanksgiving after the fear of Hurricane Florence. So walking on the beach and coming across this gigantic shell, which actually initially I thought was something plastic. And I was about to go back into the hotel and chuck it in their recycle bin or something until I realized, wait, this is the real deal. And I need to just clean this up and sort of see what it is. And it felt like the gift that had come my way because of the Atlantic Ocean, that, oh, no, sorry, we gave you a rough welcome to the city. But look, here's what we really want to give you and welcome you here. And it really brought in a whole change in my mental relationship, I feel, with Wilmington, because it just was the most beautiful gift I could have received.
I don't have my own still, but as a kid I had picked up one, and I'm fascinated by shells anyways, and mm-hmm. it was such a nice, and it's a good example of how you write too, because there is a lot about a place, a time, and the details in it, and a lot of it, and you travel in these essays too. Now you are right. In the West Coast, you're on the East Coast, you're in Italy, mm-hmm. and of course you're in India too. Mm-hmm. I hope you're going to keep sort of publishing collections of essays like this, or do you want to go back to the long form?
I think essays will always be a part of my writing life, because it's so wonderful to start with a question and then not really know what the answer is going to be, and not even necessarily having an answer by the end of writing it, but just this exploration of what it means to be, say, in a city like Wilmington right now, what it means to be in Italy when you don't speak Italian. So it starts with a question, and then this sort of travel to figure out what the answer might be. It's wonderful.
Well, I hope to have you back real soon, so write more. write quickly, write fast, write more. My guest tonight has been Sayantani Dasgupta. She's an associate professor of creative writing and a writer herself. She's at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Her latest book is a wonderful collection of essays called Brown Women Have Everything, Essays on Discomfort and Delight. It's been a pleasure, Tani.
Thank you so much, Mark. This was such a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me reading your work. So you wrote it, I only read it. you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.